There we go. Okay. Okay, so here's the thing. If you're staying in a haunted castle, do you want to see ghosts or not is the question. And I think I kind of fundamentally come down on the side of I didn't really want to, because that would be scary. But I was scared any like I was scared anyway. Like, and the thing of it is, there's all this stupid stuff, right? Like, they had like a ghost hunter that I had to interview, and I'm like, and here's my deal. I'm not really sure that I believed my man with the dowsing rods, right? Because he was giving it so large, like, oh, I just saw an apparition. Oh, I just saw that. And I was like, yeah, sure, bro. Yeah, whatever. But like, what I do believe is, so, there's the woodsman, Matt. How cool is it to be a woodsman? That's the coolest shit. Like, still being a woodsman in the year of our Lord 2020. And he was like kind of assigned to help us around because he lives on the premises. So it's like he and his wife live there. He's the woodsman. I think she kind of takes after the house, but she wasn't there because she was away for family stuff. And we were all just kind of like dicking around, talking about it, while we were setting stuff up. And he was like, yeah, do you guys believe in ghosts? And my mate Matt, who's the cameraman, is like, no, but I until I start getting scared. And then Raquel is like, I don't really know. And I was like, yeah, I'm pretty, I'm kind of like agnostic, but leaning towards, yeah, I believe in this, And Matt is like, well, I never believed in ghosts. And that I, and like, I just never really thought that this was real. And then I moved here. And he's like, there's all this stuff. Like, he's like, the number of times I've just kind of come out of my apartments at night to be like, where are those children that are running up and down the hall yelling? And it's like, there's no children staying here. Like, where are they? He's like, there's this thing, and he says multiple times, there's like a piano in the kind of hallway there. And he's like, and you can hear people playing the piano, and they're like playing a song. But the thing about that piano is it's completely out of tune. And so if you actually play it, it's like fucked, right? So it's like, so where is like this piano car? And just like all this stuff. And like, I'd overhear all the people who just work there, like the lady who worked in the gift shop, like talking to the lady who worked at the cafe. And they're like, yeah, I'm having real trouble with the ghost today. They keep like pulling out the like my phone charger and stuff like this. And it's not for my benefit, and it's not for like anything like that. So when you hear them talking about it, that's when it's like, oh. So anyway, I was freaked out enough that I slept with my light on, but I didn't see anything. But it was creepy.
I don't know.
I
Like, I
feel
mean,
you. Like, I feel it.
I don't like people who say they believe in ghosts. That's cool. Like, I don't, it's not something where I'm like ghosts are cool. Like, if they're real, that's cool. And that's something to be investigated in some way or whatever. It doesn't really matter to me. But like, when people say stuff like that, I'm like, okay, fine. You telling me you believe ghosts are real? That's cool. Now here's the next step. I understand that, for instance, like someone would be like, oh, we can't take pictures of ghosts because like the spectral blah blah blah, whatever. They just know, like, okay, cool, whatever. If there's stuff going on, like your charger comes out of the wall, you can film that. Like, so you could have stuff set up in all of these rooms, and I just want to see it. Like, okay, cool.
I
you
feel
can't
it,
see the
man.
ghost or whatever. I just want to see it. Like, it's not that I it's not that I couldn't make the jump to believe in them, or that the existence of ghosts would like
But
fundamentally
you need like
undermine.
some specific steps in order to do it.
I need specific steps in order for me to believe that you are telling me that this fell out of the wall. Like, I have a charger that I use in the kitchen sometimes. A phone charger falls out of the wall all the time because I'm like unplugging it, plug it back in. Like, it just falls out. Like, it does. Like, and again, if they're doing it, that's cool. I just want to see it. That's all I want to do. I just want to see the ghosts. I just, if somebody's playing pitch perfect piano, you can easily set up something where you can like hear that piano. You can have a camera in the room. Look, there's nobody in here. The piano case is closed. Blah, you know, whatever. Yeah. Like, whatever. I don't know. I just sound like a little bitch about it. But like, when people are like, "I saw the ghost of my dead relative," cool. You know, that's cool. Like, whatever. Good for you. But like, when it's like, this thing came in and gave me something and did something and this happens repeatedly, like, okay, cool. I want to see that.
I want to hear it.
I want to hear the piano. You know, like, I don't know. I don't know. It's just one of those, like, just show it to me. Or just be like, yeah, like, you know, I believe in ghosts, but, you know, they're ghosts. They can't, like, you know. And why would a ghost it's fine. You know what? It's fine.
Never mind.
Now I take it all back. If you tell me that ghosts exist and the only reason they exist is to fuck with us, like little, like, like little, like, woodland nymphs who just fuck with all our shit, fine. Yep, cool.
Yeah, like, I suppose what these guys are saying is, like, you know, everybody at the castle is like, they just feel like the ghosts just want your attention. And they're, like, bored.
But wouldn't I agree? I mean, okay. But wouldn't the ghost have the attention at a place specifically advertised as being haunted? Like, I don't. Like, yeah, they would so, have the most like, attention. Okay, like, there.
All right, the Lord who owns the fucking castle.
Yeah.
Like, and this shit was wild. Like, they're like talking to him. Like, I'll talk to you about ghosts. I'll talk to you about the ghosts of the landed gentry in this country, like still owning castles and shit like that. And I'm like interviewing him. And it was very funny because he's like, well, we bought the castle, you know, and everyone says, "Oh, well, he's very haunted." I say, "Okay, we'll get a man and get rid of them." You know, just, And you say, "You know, I had my cousin come. My cousin's a priest, you know." And he says, "Oh, well, I've experienced with this." So he comes in and he says, "Well, I'm sorry, old chap. There's too many of them."
And oh, like, sorry, old bean. There's too many.
It's like, and like the Lord is like, he thinks the ghosts like him because he like has done all this stuff to kind of do up the castle, and he gets them attention. He's like, you know, the ghosts have done me a great favor. You know, so people come to see them. You know, and then they see the castle, and it's like, all right, yeah, okay, but fair enough. Like, at least you're saying it. You know, but It was really beautiful, really gorgeous old castle, and really cool, like, medieval bits of it. So one way or another, like, it's cool and historic, and we were kind of, like, using it to make the point, too, that kind of, like, in a modern way, we think about ghosts in a really different way than medieval people do. Because, like, some of these ghosts are meant to be medieval or whatever, but the way that medieval people write ghost stories is totally different to how we write ghost stories and the way that medieval people think about ghosts. It's different. Yeah. This is a story for another day.
They didn't even have Monster Mash.
So no!
How could they know what the monsters were doing?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's... I enjoyed it very much, the whole thing. But it's just, I'm fucking exhausted now because there's a train strike. Like, and up, to be clear, up the CWU, like up, you know, all the strikers, massive solidarity. But when you got to get to Northumberland from London... without trains, it's like, oh, so we were like driving for 7 hours to get up there, and then it was like
7 hours.
Yeah,
Jesus.
Yeah, so it's like we had to start kind of like 8 a.m and we got there at like in 3, and then it was like start working immediately, and then we worked till 10 p.m and then it's like start working again the next day at 7 a.m and then like work until 5:30, get the train back down from York. Like, and it's, so, you know, I'm just a bit, I'm frazzled, let's put it that way. You know, it's like, the glamour of TV involves rather a lot of getting up at, like, 6 a.m., 5 a.m. And I'd rather not. Luke's like, yeah, I'm a fucking dad. I know all about
it's
that.
It's true. But I don't, nothing haunted. Nothing haunted. Nothing that I know of, you know, that I know of. It could, you know. It could be haunted, and I just haven't seen it. Yeah.
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 Felt that, man.
Yeah, for sure. I was going to ask you something. What was it? I don't remember. Yeah, I don't remember. I don't remember what I was going to ask you. So this is a great audio. You want to talk about the HRE?
Yeah, I want to talk about the HRE.
Okay, 3, 2, 1. Hello, and welcome back to We're Not So Different, a podcast about how we've always been idiots. My name is Luke. I'm an amateurish historian, and I now believe ghosts are little trickster spirits who unplug stuff from us, and I'm happy about them. And as always, I'm joined by Dr. Eleanor Yanega, who encountered ghosts herself at a scary castle the other night.
I mean, allegedly. I didn't see those little bitches.
Allegedly, I'm sorry. Allegedly.
You know what? Because I'm just too powerful and strong for them, mm-hmm, and also mm-hmm. I slept with the light on. So yeah. Like take that, motherfucker.
Yeah, take that. Oh, I'm scary. You're not scary when the light's on. Mm-hmm. What are you gonna come in here and be a little you're just gonna look like a hologram. Oh, sci-fi.
Yeah,
scary.
You're not gonna do nope. Shit.
No. Not with the light on. Ha ha, the power of light once again saves me. Yeah. Today we're talking about the Habsburg jaw and probably some other stuff about them too. And first, we have a question from Charlotte, who says, I'm back with more silly questions, this time inspired by getting absolutely eaten alive by mosquitoes. Are there any medieval recipes for bug repellent? I assume that was a thing people worried about, but without bug spray, would they just wear long sleeves or hope for the best?
This is a great question, and I like that very much, Charlotte. Keep it up. Keep it up. Keep it up. Mm-hmm. So, yep. They do have recipes and things for like pest control and like bug control. So, like we have especially like some stuff from various kind of like medical manuals and things of that nature. We have a thing kind of like for mosquitoes where they would kind of like put mosquito nets up. So they would do like kind of horsehair nets kind of stretched across the doors and interiors of houses. And then also like for a specific thing in bed, they would like soak sponges in vinegar and like put it like over the head of the bed and by the feet of the bed. And like that vinegar thing they said would like be a repellent. And then there is, like, for fleas, there's a thing where they would, like, dig a hole, grind up oleander leaves. So these are, like, Greek recipes that I got hold of. And then put these ground up oleander leaves in the hole. And those were supposed to kind of, like, attract the fleas. Attract the fleas there. And so they won't bind you. But then otherwise they say, well, you can soak your floor and kind of like put cumin and water and squirting cucumber seed all together and like put that all over your floor. And they say that it'll make fleas split.
Huh.
So like I guess it's some kind of powder that they think will desiccate them. So yeah, like the point is absolutely these are things that people are worried about. This is from... because these come from a farming manual called Giopnica, something like that, from the 10th century. So, like, this is stuff for kind of, like, ordinary, regular people. But, yeah, obviously they don't like getting bitten by things just as much as we don't, right? Mm-hmm. So, it's just that, again, it's kind of not the way that we think about it. They're more like, okay, like, mosquitoes or... fleas in these cases are kind of like a daily reality, so like maybe just try to like get them to go somewhere else instead of like the idea that you could repel them all together, if that makes sense. Yeah
that does make sense. I This is a good one because, yeah, I hate mosquitoes. They're awful.
I hate them. Yeah.
Yep. It's good to know that our phony baloney cures still don't work for keeping mosquitoes away. Yeah. Like, we have all this science and we're no closer to wiping out the mosquito, nature's worst insect that does absolutely nothing except spread disease.
Yeah.
Yet.
Yeah, we hate them. Absolutely hate a mosquito.
We kill bees easy, but not mosquitoes.
Yeah. Yeah, like, I don't want to kill the bees. Like, those are the ones that I like, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, and if you would like to ask us questions like that, that we will answer here on the show, then please, by all means, subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/WNSDpod. It's just $5 a month. We have more than 25 bonus episodes, Discord, all that sort of stuff. And yeah, episode 4 in our series on the Silmarillion will be released later this week for patrons. So subscribe if you're interested in hearing that. But now, on to the main show. So 2 episodes down in our short series on the Holy Roman Empire, and things are going pretty well for the medieval bulwark of Europe, all things considered. Powerful, legitimate heir to the legacy of the Western Roman Empire, an idea that had once been little more than a fleeting dream in the minds of Charlemagne and Pope Leo III, had become a reality. An ostensibly religiously homogenous land-based empire cobbled together from dozens upon dozens of major and minor landholdings and territories with almost as many forms of governing themselves sat astride Central Europe. In the Middle Ages and into the early modern period, it was impossible to travel from Eastern Europe to Western Europe or vice versa without passing through the Holy Roman Empire. Sure, the empire had faced adversity early, going through several feuds with the Catholic Church, most notably the investiture controversy in the 11th century and the appointment of more than a few anti-popes, but, you know, that was behind them. What's more, in the late 13th century, the empire had survived the interregnum, a dangerous power vacuum caused by a child successor that could have destroyed it through infighting. They had lost a little territory and some political prestige, but the Holy Roman Empire still stood strong near the end of the medieval era. The Ottonians and Hohenstaufens set the empire up for success, and the Luxembourgs kept it united after the interregnum. Yep, nothing but smooth sailing ahead under this new dynasty, the Habsburgs, who will rule the empire from 1440 to 1806 without interruption, except for one brief 26-year break in the 1700s. Of course, the foundational principle of religious unity had been damaged somewhat by the rise of the Hussites in Bohemia in the early 1400s, but that's just one tiny splinter sect in a territory, in one territory of the empire. What's the worst that could happen? It's not like the Catholic Church is going to launch a crusade against other Christians, right? It's certainly not going to spawn another religious schism, this one cataclysmic in nature, that splits Christendom worldwide. Nah, the empire will be fine, I'm sure. Its power is even going to expand globally under the Habsburg as it gains access to Spain's colonial holdings in the New World, thanks to Charles V, who united the emperorship and kingship of Spain under himself. And I mean, it's not like Spain is going to fumble the most lucrative bag in human history and become a bleeding ulcer that would weigh down the Habsburg emperors for hundreds of years, but becoming one of the main reasons it would be impossible for the Holy Roman Empire to successfully prosecute and win the 30 Years War. Ooh, nah, nothing to worry about. I mean, when is continuously marrying your first cousin and a steadfast inability to adjust to rapidly changing socio-political concerns ever been a problem before? Eleanor, we definitely need to do a few. I keep doing that. One of these days, I'm just Eleanor. Anyway,
Eleanor,
please save me from myself. We definitely need to do a few episodes on them in the future. But can you briefly take us through Jan Hus, the Hussites, and the Hussite Crusade? Even though those technically happened under the Luxembourgs.
Yeah. Excuse me. Yes, absolutely. Okay, so. Very, very quick. We will eventually do more on these guys because of who I am as a person. Jan Hus is a theologian and a priest. Okay, so he is active. He works at the University of Prague. And he is a big fan of John Wycliffe. We'll get into all of it later. John Wycliffe, he gets condemned by the church. And so you're not supposed to be espousing the beliefs of John Wycliffe. And Jan-Hus is like, yeah, get fucked. I'm not going to do that. And everyone at the Prague University just fucking loves Wycliffe, especially the Czech speakers, okay? He is also a preacher over in the Bethlehem Chapel. So he gets a position there. And he's got this real specific thing where he thinks that things should be done in the vernacular Czech as opposed to being done in Latin, a big thing that Wycliffe also thought. And he was, like, translating Wycliffe's texts into Czech and disseminating them in Czech. And he is a real big reformer, and he's always like, blah, 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 the church is a fuck. Number one church hater, kill all church, 1402. This is his deal, right? And hilariously, this is like super common in Prague, and the Archbishop Zbigniew Zajt is like, yeah, fuck yeah, I love this. Why don't you come like talk to the synod and stuff? Love all this. But then Pope Innocent VII is like, no. I'm afraid that we said no more Wycliffe.
No.
And the number one thing that they don't want getting taught is this thing called impanation. You know, like the Catholic way of thinking about the Eucharist is transubstantiation, so that during Eucharist, the bread and wine changes into the body and blood of Christ, right? So the Hussites and the Lollards believed the same thing, which is about impanation. And the idea there is that the bread and wine don't change substance, but nevertheless, they are like the body and blood of Christ. But these kind of things coexist.
As opposed to just being representative of the body?
Yes, which is what later on Luther thinks, right? And this is a real theological thing, because basically their deal is like, well, you know, Christ was divine even though he was made flesh. So it's the same thing as that, and they find this to be kind of like very meaningful. And anyway, the church hates that. That's not supposed to be good. Basically the Prague University absolutely fucking refuses to back down. You get a new Pope, Gregory the 12th, and he is really, really mad, because the King Charles the 4th's fail son, Wenceslaus, liked this and was like, yeah, like, keep it up. Like, who cares? But the Pope is like, I will excommunicate you, Wenceslaus. And he's like, oh. And so, like, he controls the university because his dad set the university up. So they're like, okay, well, you have to, like, surrender all your Wycliffe texts and you've got to, like, burn them. But then you get the papal schism. That's when you get, like, your Avignon Pope and your Roman Pope. And Hus is like, see, you see how this is? It's kind of like difficult because the way that the university is split up is that it's split into nations. So there's like a German nation, a Bohemian nation, like an Italian nation, and like they're like governing sectors, and they have like people from those areas say what they're going to do. So like the local bishop is like, Zeicht is like, oh, I'm going to be faithful to Pope Gregory. So that is going to be good. King Wenceslaus didn't like Pope Gregory because he thought that Pope Gregory wouldn't crown him Holy Roman Emperor. And he was right. And so like, the king and the bishop can't agree on who's the Pope, and Hus and the university are like, we're staying out of this. That's a whole problem. Then you get the degree of Cudora, where basically, Wenceslaus says that, like, everyone at the university needs to come and, like, swear allegiance to him. And the Czechs were like, sure. But, like, the Germans and the Austrians and everybody are like, no, we're not going to do it. Wenceslaus is like, okay, well, the Czechs get three says and everything, and the Germans, which are like the Bavarians and the Saxons and the Poles, they all have one together, and then everyone gets pissed off. Hus keeps like doing he thing. You get the new Pisan Pope, Alexander V, which was supposed to end the thing, but obviously it doesn't. So basically, the Hussites were like, but we're going to go with Alexander. Like, this seems like a good tiebreaker. So we will do this. And then, like, the bishop is like, yeah, okay, I will go ahead and say, I will do the same thing. But then Zait is like, well, actually, I am going to launch a complaint about, like, basically all these Lollards and Prots. Like they're calling Huss and all these guys, they're calling them Lollards at this point in time. They're calling them Wycliffeites. So then, basically, Alexander V, even though Huss and everybody was supporting them, makes papal bull, being like, yeah, Zait can go after the Wycliffeites, and, like, you're supposed to, like, burn all of the texts and everything like that. And Huss and everybody gets excommunicated by Alexander V. So Alexander V dies, and then you get John the 23rd, who succeeds him, who's also like an anti-pope essentially. And he like they are trying to drum up support for like crusades to go against like the other popes or whatever. And like he's doing like indulgences to raise money for this. And Huss is like, what the fuck is all of like this? We don't like any of this at all. That you shouldn't be selling indulgences in this way. And he also, Huss is basically like, bishops and popes shouldn't be able to take up the sword for the church. Because, like, remember when we were talking about, like, he's like, well, that's what the Holy Roman Emperor is first. And you shouldn't be able to have like forgiveness of sins in relation to money. Right, so basically everything that Martin Luther steals off later. There are some attempts to kind of like make this right. Like Huss is getting more and more popular. He's translating the book into the Bible into Czech. He's really encouraging praying in Czech and things like this. And then eventually it's like, okay, well, this is getting out of control because basically everyone in Prague is on board at this point in time. And so eventually he gets summoned to like the Council of Constance. Okay, so over in Constance in Switzerland, basically Sigismund, who is now king of the Romans, is like, get Huss over here to explain himself, because we need kind of the unity of the Holy Catholic Church, or how do I explain, the fact that I'm the king of the Romans, right? Like, and this whole council is supposed to be about like ending the schism, getting like church reform through, like getting everybody on one Catholic page, right? So they're like, we'll get Huss over here. So Huss gets guaranteed safety by Wenceslaus. And it's like, okay, well, dude, like, just go over there and take care of it. Like, no one's gonna hurt you, nothing is gonna go wrong. But Huss immediately goes in there, tells everybody to fuck themselves. It's like, you're all heretical as far as I'm concerned. You disgust me, you freaks. And like, actually, everybody should be reading the Bible in their own language. And Wycliffe rules number one. And everyone is like, okay, dude, we're gonna need to ask you to stop this. He gets put on trial in like 1415. And like they like read out all of his work and they're like, hey, do you want to repent of this? And he's like, no, fuck yourself. Like the entire time. And then they were like, well, you should recant these things. And he's like, A, fuck you, I'm not going to do it. And then B, they were like, also recant these things. And Huss is like, well, I never did those things, so I'm not going to recant of something that I didn't do, because then I'd be lying. And then they're like, okay, bro, I'm afraid if you don't do this, we are going to burn you at the stake. And he was like, yeah, fuck you, burn me at the stake. All right. And they're like, okay, I guess it's true. And he's got like the last thing that he ever says in his life, which is, God is my witness that the things charged against me I never preached, in the same truth of the gospel which I have written, taught, and preached, drawing upon the sayings and positions of the holy doctors, I am ready to die today. So they burn him at the stake. They scatter his ashes in a lake and stuff so that they cannot be like used as relics. And they're like, well, that'll take care of that. spoiler, it did not take care of that. The Czechs are pissed, right? And then they're like, okay, well, that is it. Well, I guess we're split from the church entirely because, like, you killed our homie, and we hate that. So now you've got this new pope, Pope Martin V, and he's like, well, I have a papal bull that says you can execute all supporters of Huss, right? and that goes over very poorly with the Czechs. They then get under the leadership of Jan Žižka, noted badass, and he like starts leading armies. A number of crusades are called against them, and they win a lot of them. So that's pretty good.
Yeah.
And then by 1436, basically, they kind of give up. You get the what are called the Basel Compacts. And that's like, okay, look, we're just going to let the Czechs do whatever the fuck it is they want. Like, they can have their own version of Christianity. Fine. I don't care. These are the Basel Compacts. And everyone was like, oh, okay, well, seems pretty chill. Fun fact, eventually the church in 1999, JB2, apologized for killing Jan Hus, and basically the Czechs were very happy about that.
That's
so
good.
Yeah, like they were like, our bad, but like, yeah.
Whoops. Like, whoopsie doodle.
That is like a very, very fast Jan Hus and the Hussites, yeah. Because, you know, as we say, it's just like tons of stuff to get through. But yep. Those are like the basics that you kind of need to know. And it is very much kind of like Reformation 101. Like, you heard it. It's like, you can't just buy an indulgence.
Yep.
Like, more personal responsibility. Questions about the Eucharist. Another thing that they're really into is called Utraquism, which I forgot to mention here, which is that they want to have communion. When they have communion, they want to take both the bread and the wine.
Mm.
Because, like, usually the poor don't get wine at communion. And then the other thing is they wanted to have communion more often because communion is so cool. So that was very important to them. Yeah.
People get really, really worked up about communion.
Well, yeah, it's funny because now, like, you do take communion all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, really, in the medieval period, you took it very, very infrequently. Like,
they were,
you know,
like, they were like, this is
we are not giving everybody bread.
Nope, we're not giving everybody bread. You're certainly not all getting wine. This is special.
Yeah. And so it was like, you know, you'd like maybe do it for Easter or Christmas and like at big parts of your life, like when you got married or like hopefully before you die, if you get to die the good death. Mm. But yeah.
Well, we'll just stick a little pin right there and come back to this in just a few minutes because, spoiler, the failed attempt at enforcing religious unity is only going to become a bigger problem for the empire after this. So, before we get to the Habsburgs proper, imperial reform starts to happen in the 15th and 16th centuries, and this an attempt to reform and, I guess, in a lot of ways, codify the constitutional structure of the HRE and build upon the Golden Bull of 1356. So can we just talk about that just a little and you know, what that kind of set up? And I think that kind of takes us structurally up to at least the 30 Years' War.
Yeah, absolutely. So you get to about, like, 1495. And there is like, all right, we need some reforms around here, basically, right? So there, obviously, the Golden Bull in 1356 had already kind of like tried to do some reforms as to how the practice of election within the Holy Roman Empire would go, right? And basically, the Hussites are like a big part of this because everyone is like, well, gosh, if we don't have a kind of like centralized authority when there are big kind of armed conflicts, then how do we pull things together? Because like one of the issues is people were like, well, I declined to go fight the Czechs. or whatever. And then, you know, and then eventually they were like, oh shit, maybe we do need to go fight the Czechs. And like, and it, by then it's already kind of too late. Right. So they realize they're kind of like at a disadvantage here if they don't have like a unified approach to military issues. So basically in 1486, Maximilian I, who's a Habsburg, gets elected king of the Romans. Okay. And then at the, there's an imperial diet in Worms, and Maximilian says, okay, well, basically, one of the things that we need to do in order to make sure this doesn't happen again is that, like, the estates who are kind of represented here, we don't want you to just kind of, like, be weighing in theory about what it is that we should be doing legally, which is something we'll talk about in a minute, but we also need to have, like, an imperial tax that is going to be specifically used to get troops going, right? Because it's like, there aren't really a lot of, like, imperial troops writ large. Most, like, the Habsburgs will have, like, what is called their Hausmacht. So, like, the Habsburgs can, like, raise troops out of, like, the Austrian lands, places like that. But there's no guarantee that they can get them from all over the empire. And Maximilian's beefing with the Ottomans, and he is also beefing with the French over, like, Milan, which is, you know, a time-honored tradition, beefing over who owns, like, Lombardy. And basically, the deputies kind of are like, yeah, like, we agree, like, in principle to this thing that is called the common penny. Which is like, or the for German speakers, the Reichsdauer. And basically it's like, okay, we will do like an imperial tax that you can use, like, that's going to be directly paid to the empire, but we want some things around here. So the first thing that we want is like an imperial government. And then that is going to be like the prince electors, the seven prince electors are the actual power, and the emperor is nothing but like an honorary like figurehead. Right. And Maximilian is obviously immediately like, fuck you. Like, I am obviously not going to do that. That's going to be a no from me, dog. Then like they also want what is called the perpetual public peace. And so that's like basically the empire is supposed to be not beefing. So like they don't want feuds happening anymore as a way of like settling issues, right? So part of that is like no more feuds. Why no more feuds? Because we're going to adopt Roman law, and that's like one law for all of the empire. Everybody's going to do it. We're all going to come together, and then so no more feuding, no fighting, no fucking fighting, right? Like that's what's up. And then they also want this thing, an installation of what is called the Reichskammergericht, or the Imperial Chamber Court. And so that is essentially like a Supreme Court for the Empire. Okay, and it's like, so, that's kind of like, for Maximilian, not great. He's like, this is like on the whole, this kind of weakens me. Obviously, he doesn't want the thing about like the imperial government where he wouldn't do anything, but he does like the land peace. He does like the Roman law. He does like, there's a big emphasis behind all this that there needs to be better records so that you can do things with this, right? And basically, like he says, okay, we should have like some kind of like imperial council that can be created, so that we can kind of like, you know, various people from the estates can appoint people to it. We can kind of like come together to make these sort of modernizing reforms that will make us into more of a specific state apparatus as opposed to, you know, like a series of, you know, kingdoms that are hate each other. Right. And so it's kind of like a mixed bag. So he's like, yeah, something needs to happen, but I don't want to go as far as you guys are going, right? So, like, the Roman law, this is a successful bit, right? So, like, the Roman law, people are kind of like, all right. So, like, by 1495, that is, like, more or less, everyone's like, yeah, we are going to go for that, right? because Maximilian is behind it, they're behind it, right? Now, the thing about that is that, like, they're probably at, like, higher courts. It definitely takes over, but, like, lower courts, if it's, like, small claims court between, like, two peasants in, like, somewhere out in Swabia, like, they're probably still going to be using old-school Germanic law, right,
yeah.
or whatever. But for the most part, like, it does kind of, like, take over. Okay. So that's cool. But another thing that you have around this time is you have the development around 1500 of first six, and then eventually 10 of what are called the Imperial Circles. Okay. And the Imperial Circles are cool. And these kind of like make some sense. Okay, right? So the Imperial Circles that first get set up at the Diet of Augsburg in 1500 are the Bavarian Circle, the Franconian Circle, the Saxon Circle, the Swabian Circle, the Upper Rhenish Circle, and the Westphalian Circle. And basically, what these do is they say, okay, these places are all going to have their own diet where people will get together and talk about, like, how to do the government. Taxes will kind of be, like, brought up within these particular places. And this just is, like, an administrative grouping, right? So it's just kind of, like, to basically, like, iron things out a little bit more. So you kind of, like, think about it like a state. It's sort of like a proto-state, right? So it's kind of like how we know to collect imperial taxes, how we know to, like if you go to your local diet to say, these are the things that we want. And then that'll go get repeated at the imperial diet. Right. Then about, 1512 at the, Diet of Trier, you have a few more circles that are added. So these are the Austrian Circle, the Burgundian Circle, the Rhenish Circle, and then the, I think it's the Elector of the Palatine. Yes? Sorry. Yeah. So, now, and then the Saxon Circle gets divided up, so then you have an Upper Saxon Circle and a Lower Saxon Circle, right? Because, like, the Saxon Circle was just too big. So, we got an Austrian Circle. Now, one of the things you will note in here is that there are some people who do not have their own circle. So the Czechs are like, yeah, you guys look like you're having fun. That's nice. We're Hussites. Leave us alone. Right. So so the lands of the Bohemian crown are like, no, thanks. We're not doing this. We are simply Czech people. And also the Swiss Confederacy is like, no, we're not going to do this. But basically, like, what it does is it kind of makes, like, it is a kind of smart way of organizing things. Now, some of these circles are basically necessarily attached to a particular noble house, right? So, like, for example, the Habsburgs run the Austrian Circle. The Austrian Circle is, like, the Habsburg hereditary lands. And you can tell from it, because if you ever see a map of it, like, some of the Austrian Circle is where you expect it to be, like, kind of Vienna, Graz, what have you. But then some of it is, like, all the way over, like, near Freiburg and stuff, which should be, like, in the Swabian Circle. And you're like, okay, that's, sure, why not? Okay.
Yeah, they gerrymandered the shit out of these circles.
Oh, they really do. They really
also
do.
Disappointing. Obviously, it couldn't work because of, you know, how land is, but they're not actual circles. Really, really upsetting.
Yeah, it would be really nice if they were circles. Because, like, really, they are just gerrymandered weirdo things. If we're being honest about
more proof that the United States is just the second coming of the Holy Roman Empire.
Yeah, oh yeah, completely. And like, so the Burgundian Circle, for example, is like territory that's controlled by like Spanish Habsburgs, mainly, and like the Wittelsbachs own the Bavarian Circle, things like that. So I mean, it's not necessarily dynastic, but it's kind of dynastic. Right. So you don't have to be in a circle to be in the Holy Roman Empire, because you could be like the Czechs, but a lot of people are. Yeah. Right. Let's just put it that way. And like, this is kind of like a move towards saying, yeah, okay, we need to have like a more like structured thing. Right. So there you go. You got your circles that will have your local diets, and then they feed up to what's called the Imperial Diet. And I've mentioned diets before because there's a bunch of diets already. And basically, this is kind of, think about it sort of like Congress, but it's not legislative. It's more like, because, you know, it's still the Middle Ages here, right? It's more like advisory. And the thing that's confusing about the imperial diet is that it changes over time. Right, so eventually, like, you know, separate territories may gain power or lose power at various times. And it kind of sort of, like, started out under Charlemagne-ish, but you don't always kind of, like, hold them, okay? Mm. And from 1489, basically, they have a kind of setup bit where there is, like, three bits. There's, like, three what you call colleges within the diet, okay? So there's the electors. And that's, you know, who you think it is. It's the seven imperial electors, right? So, you know, Archbishop of Mainz, Cologne, Trier, Bohemia, the Elector of the Palatinate, the Elector of Saxony, and the Margrave of Brandenburg, right? So exactly who you think. And then, like, that's who you think it is. Then you have, like, the princes. And these are, like, counts and lords and, you know, people, like, nobles, like, nobility from all over. So, like, this is how you get, like, the Habsburgs in, like, because they are Austrian, right, and they're Burgundian and stuff. So, like, how is it that they have a say? It's like, well, they have a say through the College of Princes, right? And then you have the cities.
Yeah.
Because the imperial cities, a lot of time, have their own rights, usually in exchange with the emperor. Like, they have taxation that'll go directly to the emperor a lot of times, and then they get to represent themselves. Sometimes you will have, like, religious people, like, especially later in the early modern period, you will have, like, religious people from the church also show up. But what these people are supposed to be doing is kind of, like, going through and talking about, you know, how things should be laid out. They can petition the emperor. They can say, you know, we need new laws passed about this. Taxes can be raised. Things like that. But it's not, like, they can't really make law, but they can say that's what they want. So there's always kind of, like, a restraining force with the imperial diet, but it's also not, like, it's not completely weak, but it's definitely not, like, able to kind of, like, overrule the emperor, for example.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, let's, 40 odd minutes into this episode, ostensibly on the Habsburgs, let's talk about the Habsburgs. Last week,
woo!
You gave us a little bit of a brief intro to them. So, yeah, how did they, you know, accumulate all this wealth and power and take the throne after the failure of Sigismund the
Luxembourg? Yeah, so Sigismund sucks, right?
Yep.
So he is not very good, and that's, like, a real shame for, you know, Czech people everywhere. Although Sigismund was really kind of, like, more about doing the Hungarian thing, so, like, I ain't even care that much. But Václav sucked as well, / Wenceslaus sucked as well. So, you know, like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do about that, right?
Yeah.
So people are like, yeah, we're definitely not going with another Luxembourg. What, whomst the fuck are we going to get in anyway? And, like, the thing about Sigismund is he was partially brought in because he was married to a Luxembourg. And so they're like, ooh, okay, well, this is nice. We get some representative here, right? So, basically, you get some Austrians, unfortunately, kind of get into Bohemia as well with this. So, like, you, after Sigismund gets all fucked up, you get Albert the Fifth, and he is kind of like he's a Holy Roman Emperor, and he is a Habsburg, right? So that this is where the trouble starts, right? He dies in battle against the Ottomans, okay? And the Habsburgs basically get kicked the fuck out of Bohemia, which we like. That's good. And then you kind of get the kind of, like, ascendancy now from here on out, though, of Habsburgs controlling everything. They kind of do this because, they've got a lot of power at this point in time. And they have really got a lot of control over the Austrian Archduchy. And it's kind of like none of the prince electors can kind of agree on anything else. Everybody knows they don't want any of these like Luxembourgs in. So it's kind of like, all right, well, I guess it's going to be these guys instead, right? So you have kind of like an expansion of the Habsburgs' lands around this time as well. So like from 1457 onward, you have Frederick V, and he kind of like gains a bunch of Austrian territory. And then he is like they're kind of like consolidating and consolidating and consolidating, because previously the family would sort of get split up and the lands would kind of like get, you know, like, well, a cousin's got a bit over here and a cousin's got a bit over there. But increasingly from the 15th century onward, there is an attempt to bring these lands under just like a few members of the family, right? So another thing that they managed to do is they do some really smart intermarriages, right? So like they marry their girls off really judiciously. So for example, they're able to marry into the Burgundian line. And it's the Burgundian line that gives you Maximilian, who I was talking about earlier. Maximilian, the one who's like, we need to do all these reforms. So this is a bit of a coup, right? So you've got like people who can represent the Burgundian territories, but also the Austrian territories, right? And so everyone's like, oh, well, this seems kind of good, right? So like a little bit more land comes under their power, essentially. So Maximilian then becomes king of the Romans. He's Maximilian I. I just like to say it again. Maximilian, great name. Keep it up.
It is a good name.
And then, like, this is... He is the one that does, like, the biggest expansion for the Habsburgs around this time. So his son Philip, who's Philip the Fair, marries Joanna of Castile, who is the heiress of Castile, right? They have a bunch of kids, like a whole mess of kids. And the eldest of those kids is Charles V. Okay. Now, Charles V is there for inheriting Castile and Aragon. And because he is a Habsburg, he also rules southern Italy, Austria, and the Low Countries. He's actually born in the Low Countries. And like, so he's like born, I think, in Ghent or something like that. Yeah. And, but he's also like Spanish at the same time. And then at the same time, they are also in control of Austria-Hungary. Okay. Because there is kind of like a big wedding between Louis, who is the son of Vladislaus II, who's the king of Bohemia and Hungary, and Maximilian's granddaughter, Mary. And like they also do a big thing where they marry the Archduke Ferdinand to Louis's sister Anna, right? So double wedding, right? And they're like, we are just sewing this shit right the fuck up, right? Like we are owning all of these lands as the same family, right? So basically, like then Vladislaus like dies, and Maximilian dies, and this means that Ferdinand becomes the king of Bohemia and Hungary. He's the guy who's kind of like left over. And so this is all while Charles V gets elected Holy Roman Emperor. So his brother's in charge of Hungary and Bohemia. He's in charge of Spain, the lowlands, like the boot part of Italy, Sicily, Corsica, like you name it. And he's the Holy Roman Emperor, right? So on the one hand, you would be all like, well, awesome, we control rather a lot of land, like look at us, we are the Holy Roman Emperor's par excellence, look at our emperor, like look upon my empire, ye mighty, in despair. But turns out it's really hard to run this much place, especially when they have drastically different needs and wants at this particular time. There is a lot to say about that. So I'm going to try to do it. I guess that like, which rather brings us on to the Reformation, right?
Right, right. Yeah. So, and this, the Reformation, happens under Charles V. So even as they got all that world spanning power, it just started to crumble in their hands. 102 years after Jan Hus was executed for heresy, Martin Luther nails 95 theses to the door of a church. And within a couple years, all hell had broken loose in the Holy Roman Empire, and that it spread much further as well. You know, cities, regions, families were split by the emergence of Lutheranism. Must soon be joined by Calvinism and something that most people don't ever talk about anymore, but was apparently like the scariest thing in the world at the time, Anabaptism. Ooh. So, yeah, how does, I guess it sounds almost silly to ask, but how does the Reformation attack the structural, you know, the foundational structure of the HRE?
Yeah. So remember we talked in the last episode about, you know, the allegory of the two swords and everything. Mm-hmm. So it's like, the trouble is if you don't agree that the church is who controls Christianity, then you can't possibly agree that the emperor is like the representative of the secular concerns of the church, right? If you don't agree with the church, then you don't agree with the fact that there's a Holy Roman Emperor. And, like, that's just it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a bunch of the prince electors all switch over to Protestantism.
Mm.
And now, my students are always asking me about this. My students are like, oh, well, did they do it because they, like, really believe in it? Or are they doing it for power? And it's like, well, I couldn't possibly say, right? Yeah. Because... It's certainly true that, like, you would get a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of secular power, a lot will come from separating from this. And you can also see why people would want to do it. So say that you are, I don't know, the Elector of Saxony. Mm-hmm. Then why do you want, like, the Habsburgs, who control every fucking thing, to also be telling you what to do with your land?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, this is a real issue. And so you have this thing start up that's called the Schmalkaldic League, which is all of the Protestant princes. And they actually get in bed with King Francis of France, who hates Charles V because he wanted to be elected Holy Roman Emperor, and it didn't work. So they all start, like, a military alliance in order to, like, specifically attack Charles V, and be like, well, you can't do a crusade against us because we're all kind of like militarily linked.
Mm-hmm.
And Charles V goes really heavily into like, well, I need to do something about all these goddamn Protestants. And you can understand why, because, you know, the existence of Protestants like calls into question his existence as the King of the Romans, right?
Mm-hmm.
Holy Roman Emperor. But he's also got several other problems as well. On the Eastern Front, his brother's lands over in Austro-Hungary are being attacked by the Ottomans. and in Spain, he has real problems with the Moriscos. So there are kind of constant attacks along the coasts of Spain from the Barbary Corsairs, who are essentially like Muslim pirates.
Mm.
Kind of like they set up in Tunisia, they take Tunisia off of Charles V, and they'll just like attack the coastline all the time. So the Spanish subjects of the Habsburgs are like, we have real fucking problems with these pirates all the time. Can you please focus on this? The Viennese subjects of the Habsburgs are like, oh my God, there are Turks outside. Can we deal with this? The Ottoman Emperor makes a pact with Francis I of France. So if Charles, like, so that, like, now France and the Ottomans are in cahoots because they're like, just to fuck Charles up. So you can't even really communicate very effectively throughout the empire here because, like, France is cutting off Spain from the rest of the Holy Roman Empire. You can't, like, go overland to get messages in between. So you've got to do it through the Mediterranean and get over to Italy. France and the Holy Roman Empire are fighting over who owns Milan, so you've got to, like, pick, you know, how you're even going to land. Plus, there's a bunch of pirates that are going to intercept messages. And it's just too much. right? Like, it's so, so much stuff that eventually it, like, drives Charles V essentially to, like, a breakdown.
Yeah.
Right? So a couple things kind of, like, happen here. So you have, like, the big splits with Lutheranism, where cities go really heavily Lutheran.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason for that, and it's because cities are really literate.
Mm.
And so they are, they all can read and write, and so they're taking advantage of all these German pamphlets that are being printed that, like, tell them more about things. And so they're like, oh, fantastic. So they're like, yeah, well, we're Lutheran now. This is a real blow to the emperor because the cities are often, you know, imperial, and they're the ones who are, like, paying him taxes. So they don't believe in him. So it's like, oof, that's no good. Mm-hmm. You then later get, like, Calvinism, Anabaptism, other, like, flavors, because now that you can just, like, if you've got a printing press, you can come up with your own idea. Like, people really do that, right?
Yeah.
So you got the princes on the one hand, you've got the cities on the other. Like, the countryside, it really depends. Some peasants are really kind of, like, down for the struggle. Hilariously, there's a big peasant uprising that, like, Luther condemns.
Yes.
Because he's like, fuck these peasants.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't say, like, make a more fair world. I just said, like, stop having the church, right? So anyway, there's all of these problems by these damn pesky these pesky little Protestants, and then eventually you get to what is called the Peace of Augsburg in 1555.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it is an agreement between Charles V and the Schmalkaldic League, and they're like, basically, we are going to say that there can be different kinds of Christianity permanently within the Holy Roman Empire. So you can have Lutheranism or you can have Catholicism. You could still kind of have Hussitism, sort of. Like, it depends. Like, people are not asking checks, really.
Yeah.
That's why it's like, this entire time, it's like, just don't look at the checks because it complicates this narrative, right? And so there is within the Peace of Augsburg this particular idea, which is quius regio, eius religio. So basically, which means whose realm, his religion. So if your prince is Protestant, then there's Protestantism in his league. If he is Catholic, then it's Catholic, right? It's kind of good, but, like, not really. Right, because it's like, so what if you are a Catholic and you're in the Protestant bit? Like, what do you do about this? And, like, it's kind of a step in the right direction, but I wouldn't call it ideal, right? Mm-hmm. And basically, this was negotiated by Ferdinand, Charles's brother, not Charles himself, because Charles was just, like, busy losing his goddamn mind. And it just kind of, like, it placated a lot of the towns and knights, basically. But there is also kind of, like, some exemptions to this underneath what is called the Declaratio Ferdinandi, which is fun to say, which is kind of, like, signed in 1555. And this is, like, okay, well, this is going to kind of, like, mean that you need to come down on one side or the other, maybe pick it, what it is that you're going to do, because we're trying to kind of, like, bring this in. This is going to be how we do it. Basically, like, this, it's a cute idea, right? Like, it's a cute idea, I guess, like, for the time. But the fact of the matter is, it doesn't really guarantee any form of freedom of religion. It's just kind of like the tyranny of a one group of rich people over everybody else. And it will take a long time for things to kind of shake down into, no, you can choose what it is you want. And ultimately, all that ends up happening here is that rich people still get to tell you what to do. I mean, unsurprisingly. Yeah. But, like, that's the fastest way I can do the Reformation and what it means in terms of the Holy Roman Empire.
It's kind of where we're gonna leave it today. You know, the one of the uh the foundational pillars has, you know, been cracked wide open, and they've only papered over it. They have not, they've not really done anything to actually fix the problem, and that will have to be sorted out the only way it can when you have concerns like this, and that is, of course, huge continental scale violence. Yeah, that ends up changing Europe forever, changing a lot of things, but we'll get there next time. Oh, I did want to ask one more thing.
Yeah.
So we started with the Habsburgs. When do they start getting the jaw? Like, when does that start showing up in the...
Great question. So it kind of starts in, we think, with Mary of Burgundy, who I mentioned. You know, she marries into the family in 1477. And she, like... she doesn't have like very much, like, so you can use her as kind of like she's the test case, and that she doesn't have like the crazy jaw. And then like the most jaw will happen in kind of like 1621 with Philip the Fourth, God bless him. So the answer is it starts coming in around this time. so like Maximilian the First had like a crazy jaw. And he's like 1493. So it's kind of like with him, like he kind of like picks it up. So it's like his mom, like nothing to do with it, like not her fault or whatever, but it's just like suddenly like bang, big old jaw. And then his daughter has it, his nephew has it, like all these other people have it. And because they keep kind of like marrying other Habsburgs, that really gets like passed down. So the answer is like kind of Maximilian era, like so fairly early on, like surprisingly, like it's not even that it's not even like that late. It kind of seems to have like appeared with Maximilian, and then it seems to be kind of dominant. So you see it. And then, like, you really, really see it with a poor Ferdinand. God bless him. It's like, the more land there is, the more they marry in to each other. And so it's like, yeah. So kind of like the 15th century is the answer. It starts out in the 15th century, but the highest form will come right at the end with poor little Ferdinand. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. I said we would get into the jaw, and there it is here at the very end. Next time on our next episode, we will conclude our short series on the Holy Roman Empire with an episode on the 30 Years' War.
Yay!
And then a little bit of the final years as, you know, the Habsburgs, as the Habsburgs and the Empire fade away into obscurity and eventually the dustbin of history, but yeah, we'll get there. As we said earlier, a new episode on the Silmarillions coming out for patrons later this week, so check that out. But anyway, in the meantime, Eleanor, where can the people find your work?
Yeah, you can check out my blog at going-medieval.com. I'm on Twitter as @goingmedieval. You could please pre-order my book, The Once in Future Sex. And at the end of the month, if you subscribe to History Hit TV, which is online, you can watch my little ghost show I made. Yeah.
Yay.
Yay, yep. Ghosts.
And yay, ghost. It's like a Scooby-Doo episode. Mm. Yay, ghost. Anyway, my name is Luke. You can find me at LucasAmazing on Twitter. You can find my old show, People's History of the Old Republic, on wherever you're listening to podcasts right now. It's about Star Wars. Check it out if you want. But thank you once again for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.